In 1991, Linda Greenlaw was captain of the Hannah Bowden, a swordfishing ship that was the sister ship of the Andrea Gale. The Andrea Gale was the ship that went down and its crew died in what was known as the Perfect Storm. That became Sebastian Younger's book in 1997, and then the movie in 2000 with George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg and Diane Lane and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio playing Linda Greenlaw. Linda took a decade off from sword fishing to write several books and pick up a whole bunch of lobster traps. She wrote several bestsellers, nonfiction books like The Lobster Chronicles and All Fishermen Are Liars and The Hungry Ocean, as well as a couple of fiction books, a couple of mysteries. Now she has a new book out about her return to the sea as the captain of a sword boat. It is called Seaworthy. And Linda, I'm happy to have you on the show today.
Hi, good afternoon.
Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Why are you not on the water?
Yeah, I know, right? I'm in the middle of a book tour. I'm sort of landlocked right now.
Is that costing you money? I mean, I know you're eventually going to sell a lot of books, but how does that compare to the sword fishing business?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'd rather be fishing, but the publishers are pretty good. They set the whole thing up and fund it, and at the end of the whole game, we hope we all make money.
I mentioned that you were away from the job for a decade. How hard was it to get back on a ship and go out to the Grand Banks and try to find swordfish again?
Well, you know, it was somewhat. The fishing itself was like riding a bike, but I don't know. I felt like I was risking quite a bit. The 10 years that I was not swordfishing, as you mentioned, I was a much tamer fishery, inshore lobstering here, and I always wanted to go back to swordfishing. Never dreamed I'd never go back to it, but the more the years marched on and you know, I couldn't accept the opportunities that were coming my way to go sword fishing. I either had 800 lobster traps in the water or I was in the middle of a book tour. You know, I could never go. I realized it was unlikely I'd ever get back. So 2 years ago, the phone rang, and I said, yep, I'm going. And I went again last year, and I'll be going again this year. So it's worked out pretty well.
I'm always fascinated with process, which is why I like to talk to people who have done jobs that I not only couldn't do but never would do, who can explain what the process is behind their job. You have a unique job, and you're in a unique position within your industry as the only female sword boat captain. So can you tell me and my listeners what it means to go out there? How do you fish for swordfish?
Okay, well that, I'll try and keep that as short as I can. The method we use to catch swordfish is called long lining, and it's basically fishing with hook and line. We fish one single strand of line that's about 40 miles long, and we attach baited hooks onto it. We set it out at night and leave it drifting free from the boat over the course of the night because swordfish come to the surface at night to feed. The next morning at daylight, we pick up the end of that 40-mile string and start getting it back on the boat. We call that hauling back. It takes most of the daylight hours to get the gear back, and you know, depending on the weather and how many fish you're catching or how many sharks you're catching, it could take longer or shorter. We keep our trips in sync with the lunar cycle. So the trips are basically 28 to 30 days dock to dock. So it's a lot of time at sea. And each 24-hour cycle or set, we hope to average, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 pounds of fish a night. And at the end of our trip, hopefully we have enough to go in and make some money.
How many fish does it take to make 3,000 or 4,000 pounds?
Well, last season we had the biggest average fish I've ever seen since the age of 19, and that was 171-pound average. That's very unusual. They generally, I don't know, hopefully that's a sign of good things. But typically, you know, closer to a 100-pound average. So, you know, 30 fish would be around 3,000 pounds.
You're putting out 40 miles of line, and you're catching 30 fish. If I had to guess how many it was, I would have guessed a much higher number.
Well, that's an average, you know. It is fishing. You know, you have some nights where you catch, you know, far fewer than 30 fish, and you have... You like to think you're going to have nights you're going to get 100 fish. But, you know, 30 fish a night for an average, you know, you can put a trip together. You're not getting rich, but, you know, you're going to make a paycheck.
What else gets caught up in the hooks besides swordfish?
Well, the other things that we like to see are mako sharks because there's a market for them. We love to catch tuna, especially late in the fall when they have a big fat content. We get big money for giant bluefin tuna, yellowfin tuna, big eyes. We occasionally catch some albacore tuna. Sometimes, depending on where we're fishing, we catch mahi-mahi, which also is a good market for that. So, yeah, that's all good.
When I was reading the book, I was fascinated to find out that the captain and the entire crew are on deck when it's time to haul in that line. Everybody pitches in to bring in those fish, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's all hands on deck. And as I said, last season, with a big, 171-pound average fish, it does take, four or five people to get one of these things aboard the boat once it's alongside the boat.
So as you're hauling the line in, you have to not only battle these fish, but also the elements. And there's a story involving one of your crew that you nearly lost, which I'd love you to share with my audience, because it is such a heart-wrenching story that, as I've heard the story, I was right there along with you on board. Can you share that story with my audience?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, when we're hauling back the gear, whenever a fish comes alongside the boat, there's a cut in the hull of the boat called a door. Some people call it a tuna door. It's just a place where the hull has been cut out so you can drag a fish right in onto the deck instead of going up and over the rail. So you don't have to pull the fish up as far. It's just kind of sliding it into the boat through this door.
Yep.
Well, typically we'd have that door closed. We'd have a piece of steel down into it so, nothing would fall overboard. Well, the Seahawk, which is the boat I was running during the trip that I write about in Seaworthy, the door didn't fit in that well. It was hard to get in and out, so we kind of left it open a lot. We had one day when the weather was horrendous. I mean, it was really, really bad weather. We have 40 miles of gear in the water. We have to get it back on the boat. You can't just wait for the weather to get good, because sometimes it just doesn't get good. So we're hauling the gear, and we're catching some fish, which is great. We have three or four fish on the deck, and we took one gigantic sea aboard the boat, and water was just everywhere, and everything was adrift. I was just holding on, so I wouldn't go overboard with the water that was going over. And I look back in the stern, kind of wanting to do a head count, make sure everyone's there, and I see one of my crew members, Mike Machado, laying down in the water, just like nothing to grab hold of, and he's going right for the door. A big swordfish went out the door and splashed. Mike Machado's heading for the door, and I felt sick. I mean, there wasn't anything I could do about it, and I'm thinking, he's a goner. If he goes through that door, there's no way I'll be able to get him back. The weather's too bad. I mean, maybe I'll chop him up in the propeller if he goes under the boat. Very, very difficult situation. Well, just before he actually exited the boat, another crew member came from the stern and tackled him, basically pinned him to the deck. Just a miracle they didn't both go through the door and overboard. But closest I've ever come to losing a man overboard.
When somebody does go overboard, was it the conditions that would have made it impossible for you to get him?
Yeah, it's just the bad conditions. I mean, if anybody goes overboard off a sword fishing boat, it's going to be because the weather's very bad. You're not just going to fall off a boat unless you get washed overboard with a big sea like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very difficult to get this boat back in bad sea conditions and a lot of wind to get the boat back to the man overboard before they sink out of sight. Now, they got full oil gear on, these bib overalls and rubber boots, and with the bad weather like that, they aren't going to be on the surface very long before they sink.
Talking with Linda Greenlaw about her book Seaworthy, A Sword Boat Captain Returns to the Sea. When you first started out in the business as a teenager, were there guys who said, you're a woman, you can't do this job?
Not so much. You know what? I either have a very thick skin or a very thick skull. I'm not sure, maybe both. People ask me about gender problems all the time, and I never really noticed them. I don't know. I found something that I love to do. I worked really hard at it, became captain in a very traditional way. I stayed on the same boat long enough to become first mate, and owner of the boat bought a second boat, and I'd been there the longest. It was kind of my turn. It's really a traditional way to move up the ladder, and I always hire my own crew, so I like to think any man who doesn't want to work for a woman, or especially go to sea for 30 days with a woman, is not going to ask me for a job. That's not to say I've never had crew problems. I have. Some people just don't work out. It's not for everyone. But the problems that I've encountered haven't been, gender-based, if you know what I mean. Other captains have similar problems.
Yeah. I would guess also that after a while, experience counts, and since you're the one who's hiring the people coming to work for you, if they're good at what they do, they probably already know that you're good at what you do.
Absolutely. Everyone has a reputation. I've been in this business since I was 19 years old. I don't have any problem finding crew members. You know, when I get a good boat like the Hannah Bowden, and that's the boat that's featured in The Perfect Storm, that boat's the Cadillac of the fleet. I'm going to be able to get the cream of the crop for crew members. Everybody wants to go on the best boat, the biggest boat, the fastest boat, the boat with the best equipment, because, you know, that's the boat that's going to make the most money.
Now, speaking of that, the boat you ended up on when you went back out to sea wasn't exactly the cream of the crop. The Seahawk was more the cream of the crap. Right?
Yeah, you got that one right. Yes. Yeah, well, after being out of the business for 10 years, I guess I didn't really expect to sort of step right aboard the best boat, you know, where I'd left off. Kind of have to work your way back up. And, yeah, I was definitely on the bottom of the barrel on the Seahawk, to say the least.
When you get on board a boat that has problems, one of the biggest problems for people in your line of work, obviously you need the boat to do what a boat does, but you also need the equipment essential to the job to work correctly. And you had considerable problems with the ice maker. You're making ice every day at sea, right?
Yes, we make ice from seawater. It keeps the fish a lot better than freshwater ice. And we did have problems with the ice machine. That's, you know, critical. Obviously, if you can't make ice, you can't keep your fish. And we get paid by the, you know, on the quality of the fish. So it's very important to us to have a really, really good, pristine, good quality product when we hit the dock. And you can't do that without ice.
So when you come back and you've been out there for 4 weeks, as you say, because you go on a lunar cycle, are there fish that have been frozen for 4 weeks at that point?
No, the saltwater ice is 4 degrees colder than freshwater ice. It doesn't freeze them. They're still fresh fish. And it's amazing if the fish is cared for properly, which is our goal. Obviously, we're not going to get as much money for a fish that doesn't look good or is stinky as we are for a really, really good fish. So, you know, we've gotten pretty good. We've got good methods, and we have all the incentive in the world to be landing very beautiful fish.
What do you eat on board a sword boat? Do you eat swordfish, or is that eating your own money?
Yeah, occasionally we do. Once in a while, we'll catch a swordfish. We call it a chunk, and it's a fish that a shark has taken a bite of after it's been on the hook. So the fish is, you know, kind of low-hanging fruit, if you will, on a hook already.
Yeah.
And a shark will take a bite out of it, and the guy who cleans the fish, we call him the butcher. When he's cleaning that bite up, it's not uncommon to cut some steaks off of that fish that's had the bite out of it, and we get a good meal out of it.
You talked about how you go out there and lay out 40 miles of line. Do you ever have a problem where you steam across your? I know it's not steam at this point, but where you go across your own line and cut it?
Yes, yeah, that's not that unusual. Most of the boats have these things called paravanes or outriggers, and they work to stabilize a boat. They're basically two big booms that hang off the sides of the boat like arms, one on either side, and they have these big birds that swim under the water hung by chain, and those definitely drag. You drag those deep enough to cut your own line or someone else's if you accidentally steam across it, and steam is the right word.
Okay, so what happens then? I mean, you got to cut line. It's 40 miles long. You may have done it a couple of times at some point. Do you have to pull them back in and stitch them back together?
Yeah, we call that a part off, and the next day we don't realize we've done it until the next day when we're actually hauling the gear back. If you come to a bitter end before you have all your 40 miles back on the boat, we call it a part off, and then you have to go look, you know, for the next end where you severed it or where a shark bit it off, or weather can sometimes part you off also. And we have these things called beeper buoys on the boat that we put every 3 or 4 miles. You have a beeper on the line, and if you get a part off, there's a machine in the wheelhouse or the bridge of the boat called an automatic direction finder, and each beeper buoy has its own frequency. For instance, I'm parted off, I run to the wheelhouse, I know the next beeper I'm looking for has a frequency of 1729. I tune that in, and every 3 minutes I get a signal from this machine. It actually points the direction of the next beeper.
Hmm.
So, you know, it does cut down on the sort of searching the entire ocean for your next piece of gear.
Yeah. And you mentioned that sometimes other ships might cut your line or you might cut theirs. Does that mean that there are multiple sword boat lines in one area at the same time?
Yeah, they're a deep draft ship, such as an oil tanker or a container ship or a big freighter. You know, they're steaming through the area where we fish all the time, and they'll part us off. We part each other off, and we do all fish in an area. It's not really crowded, though. It's a big ocean, and there aren't that many boats going where I fish, which is east of Newfoundland. There aren't that many boats from the United States who go there anymore. So it's really plenty of room.
Let's talk about Newfoundland for just a second, because you ended up in a prison there.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to bring that up.
Of course I'm going to bring that up, because to me this is one of the great stories in the book, which is you just didn't know exactly where you were. How does that happen?
Right, yeah. Big, stupid, innocent mistake, but very costly. I set my 40 miles of line, made a very legal set. Canada has a 200-mile limit. You can't fish within 200 miles of their shores. The United States has one also. Most countries do. I'm very aware of the 200-mile limit and never have broken a law intentionally in my life. Made a legal set, and the next day we were in the process of hauling it back. Ended up being a long day for a variety of reasons. And we've got like two-thirds of the gear back, and we got buzzed by a Canadian Fisheries Patrol plane, which is not unusual. They do, protect their border there pretty diligently. So we all kind of looked up and waved at the plane, and a few minutes later they buzzed us again. And the third time they buzzed us, I said to the crew, hey, I've got to run up topside and see what's going on. Maybe they're trying to get in touch with me for some reason. I took one step into the wheelhouse and looked at the chart plotter, which shows your position, and could have thrown up. I mean, I could see I was 4 miles on the wrong side of that Canadian line.
Oops.
Yeah, oops, big time. Couldn't imagine how it had happened. I know what the Gulf Stream does. I know what the Labrador Current does. My gear should have drifted away from that line, not over it and into, illegal territory. As you said, I was arrested and I was handcuffed and put in jail. And when I was released, it wasn't until after I got back out fishing, after I was released from jail, that I found out what had happened. And a friend of mine, I had to leave a piece of gear behind because I was arrested. A friend of mine came upon that piece of gear and called on the radio and said, hey, Seahawk, this is your gear. I'll pick it up and I'll deliver it to you when I get close. So I said, yeah, that'd be great because this stuff's expensive. You don't want to leave any behind.
Yep.
And he called me back on the radio after he had it on his boat. And he's like, hey, it's been run over by a ship. It's all covered with bottom paint, anti-fouling paint. It's all in a big heap instead of being stretched out, in a single strand. It was all a big knot, big snarl. So that's, finally was like the aha moment. It was a little late. Although, in hindsight, it wouldn't have made any difference because intention has nothing to do with Canadian law. It's, I was there. I was wrong. Busted.
Yeah. How much time did you spend in prison before they made you write a big check?
No, I was only in jail for a day, and I was released because, the bail money was in place for the boat and myself. I had to go back to court. I was a week in Newfoundland when I had to go back to court several months later, and then I wrote the big check.
We were talking before about being out there and having other captains and other ships, and they're all fishing in the same area. And, of course, we started the conversation with the reference to the perfect storm in 1991, where you were on the phone with the captain of the Andrea Gale as he was heading off into this unbelievable storm that ended up taking his life and everyone else's. In all your communication with the other captains now, do you run into anything that even approximates that?
No, and actually I never ran into it during the perfect storm either. It's Hollywood, and it's a great movie, but all that screaming back and forth never happened. I hate to, have people disenchanted with the movie because certainly a great movie, but that's not the way it was.
Other than that, were you happy with Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio playing you?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. When I heard Clooney was playing the lead, I begged to play myself. it seemed that they wanted a real actress. I don't know, something about selling tickets. So I was, when I found out who she was, just delighted. I mean, she's beautiful, and she did a good job, yeah.
She sure did. All right, now you're going to eventually get back on a sword boat, and it won't be the Seahawk, the one that was all beat up and was the lowest rung on the sword boat ladder. Do you get to get better boats now? Is your reputation back to a point where an owner is going to say, I want you, and I'm going to put you on the cream of the crop again?
Yeah, I am psyched. August 1st, I'm getting back aboard the Hannah Bowden, which is a boat I had during the perfect storm. So I am pretty excited about that.
You have led an amazing life, and you continue to do so. How many more years do you see yourself living your life at sea?
Well, I'm sure I'll spend, the rest of my life at sea in some capacity. I'm not sure it's going to be on a sword fishing boat 30 days at a time, 1,000 miles from the closest dock during hurricane season. But I think I've got a few seasons left of me of sword fishing, and then we'll see what happens.
Linda's book is called Seaworthy, A Swordboat Captain Returns to the Sea. It has been a great pleasure talking to you. Good luck with the book and good luck with your next sail.
thank you very much.
Linda Greenlaw here with Paul Harris on the Big 550 KTRS.